Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. The top Democrat in the New York State Senate joined other progressive state lawmakers from across the country this week to denounce funding cuts from Congress. They warn that the budget reconciliation bill is already starting to affect their constituents. Jung Yoon Han from the New York Public News Network with more.
Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins says the reconciliation bill, which is President Trump's most important policy agenda, is drastic for New Yorkers. Medicaid cuts alone could transfer $3 billion in costs to the state. Stewart-Cousins, who chairs the National Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, says many of these cuts won't kick in until after the 2026 midterms. But she says she and other state Democrats are going to make what Trump calls the One Big Beautiful Bill a key part of their strategy against Republicans to win more congressional seats.
They all voted yes. They stayed silent. They chose their party over their people.
Some state lawmakers have speculated that they may need to come back to Albany later this year for a special legislative session to address the cuts. Stewart-Cousins says there are no plans for that yet.
Whatever we have to do, we're going to do on behalf of our constituents to the extent we can.
A spokesperson from the governor's office says they are in ongoing conversations about funding cuts with leaders in the Assembly and Senate. In Albany, I'm Jung Yoon Han for the New York Public News Network.
The first National Semiconductor Technology Center has opened its doors to innovation in Albany. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse Taylor reports.
I'm proud to announce that America's first ever National Semiconductor Technology Center has officially opened here at Albany Nanotech. We didn't want it in any other place.
The NY Creates Albany Nanotech Complex was named as the country's first national semiconductor technology center in October. Under the 2022 CHIPS and Science Act, the designation puts Albany at the center of high-tech industry research and development. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke during a grand opening celebration Monday.
Countries are now looking here at the Capital Region as the new epicenter for innovation, not just for America, but for the world. We're planting a flag, sending a message loud and clear that the future of chips will not be discovered overseas.
The facility is home to the nation's first extreme ultraviolet accelerator, which began operating on July 1st. It enables researchers from NSTC member organizations, NY Creates, and NatCasts, a nonprofit entity that operates NSTC, to drive the commercialization of advanced semiconductor technology. NY Creates President David Anderson says the technology is essential to many everyday products, including smartphones.
And the strategic importance of that to the nations and the nation's economic and national security is imperative. So the technologies that we are developing in this new EUV accelerator are driving the next generations of semiconductor technology, which will be important for many decades to come.
Anderson says NY Creates added almost 200 jobs in Albany in preparation for the new facility. He predicts the EUV accelerator will generate interest from companies around the world, leading to even more jobs.
I think we'll see, you know, hundreds of new jobs as a result of this, and perhaps that'll parlay into thousands of new jobs across the state.
The Albany Nanotech campus will house an advanced lithography system, a machine that will enable developers to create smaller, faster, more powerful chips.
It works with a high-power laser zapping 50,000 droplets of molten tin per second to create the EUV light.
Anderson says it allows for the creation of lines on the boards of chips that are less than 2 nanometers, smaller than the width of human hair. Congressman Paul Tonko, a Democrat from the 20th District, says the grand opening marks an important development in the economic future of the Capital Region.
The EUV accelerator will not only drive the next generation of semiconductor manufacturing, but will also create those very important pathways pathways for workforce development and collaboration amongst academia, government, and of course, private industry.
The EUV Accelerator is currently accepting applications. Reporting from Albany, I'm Jesse Taylor.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Susan Lerner, Executive Director of Common Cause, about legislation that authorizes New York to join ERIC, also known as the Electronic Registration Information Center.
It is a nonprofit organization that was started by a number of states, actually at that time Republican states, to ensure that the voter rolls in their states were as accurate as possible. So, Dave, you know, people in the United States move all the time. People move within states, people move outside of states. And when you're trying to load that van and get your stuff to a new location for a new job or a new start in some way, you're not thinking about your voter registration. So people leave the state and they don't inform the Board of Elections, oh, I'm not going to be voting in New York anymore. I'm now living in Georgia. I'm now living in Kansas or California or wherever. And they get to their new location, and when there's an election, they just go ahead and they register. Without ERIC, there isn't a good way for the new state to tell the old state, take that person off your voter rolls. They're now registered in my state. So ERIC is a way for the states that are part of the consortium, and there are 24 of them now, to exchange voter information to clean up their voter rolls, to be sure that their voter rolls are accurate and only contain the names of people who are actually resident in the state and registered to vote. And, you know, New York's voter rolls have not been perfect. Nobody's voter rolls are perfect, but we've had some challenges in New York. And I know that the State Board strongly supports joining ERIC because it will allow them to have an effective way to be sure that our voter rolls are as accurate as we can make them.
In any way, are you worried about birthright citizenship and the idea of who would qualify and be eligible to vote in the future if that should go bye-bye?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that there's any way in which birthright citizenship can be simply disappeared. It is part of our U.S. Constitution, and in order to do away with it, you have to go through a really significant process of amending our Constitution. And quite frankly, Dave, I don't think that most people have any problem with the idea of birthright citizenship. It's been part of our law pretty much from the beginning. If you were born here, you are a citizen.
That's Susan Lerner, Executive Director of Common Cause. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. One of the shinier proposals from New York City mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani is to make the MTA's bus system, the largest in the country, fare free. As New Yorkers debate the idea's feasibility, lawmakers in Westchester County are working to crack down on fare evasion after years of offering free bus programs. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King brings us more.
In 2022, Westchester County eliminated summer bus fares on its countywide system, the B Line. The Free B program was touted as a way to increase ridership after the COVID-19 pandemic and help low-income residents access some of the county's biggest attractions during the summer. But 3 years later, fares are back on. Not only that, but county lawmakers are introducing legislation that would establish civil penalties for those that dodge the $2.75 bus fare. Here's Democratic County Executive Ken Jenkins.
There's been some speculation, and certainly after we've had free buses in the past, that fare enforcement is lax. People skipping the payments, et cetera, so to speak. But you have to pay to ride, and this is something we're actively working to address.
Jenkins says the B-Line, which serves roughly 100,000 riders a day, is missing out on an estimated $1 million in revenue each month. The new bill would fine riders $50 for the first time they fail to pay the fare, and $100 for every offense after that. The move is in contrast to a particularly hot topic in New York City: should more buses be free? The Metropolitan Transportation Authority wrapped a pilot program offering a free bus route in each of the five boroughs last year, finding ridership increased on each route. Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, sailed by former Governor Andrew Cuomo and other candidates in the Democratic primary with a platform that included making the buses faster and permanently fare-free. Riders' advocates are cheering the idea. Danny Perlstein with the Riders Alliance says free buses would make the city more affordable for its poorest residents.
In New York City, millions of bus riders are overwhelmingly low income and struggling to afford everything, you know, from rent to groceries to medicine. And so making the buses free takes some of the pressure off, right? It could save somebody $1,000 or $1,500 a year. That makes a difference in people's lives.
Others are more skeptical.
Just like that old saying, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, there ain't no such thing as a free bus. That's just an illusion. The question is, who pays?
Andrew Rain is the president of the Citizens Budget Commission, a nonpartisan think tank analyzing the city's finances. Rain says there are hurdles Mamdani would have to overcome to make free buses a reality, besides, of course, winning the mayoral election in November. For starters, New York City has the largest bus system in the country. While it lags behind the subway in ridership, the MTA says city buses served more than 409 million riders last year, and the revenue from those riders contributes to its overall operations. Rain says the estimate for what it would cost to replace that revenue each year ranges from $600 to $900 million.
The city has a huge budget problem. Whoever is elected in November is going to, 16 days later after they're inaugurated, propose a balanced budget and close a $5 to $7 billion budget gap. I'm not sure where that next $600 to $900 million would come from, because I'm not sure how they would plan to close the first part of the budget gap. And that is before it gets whacked by the federal cuts.
Rain says the money would likely have to come from the state, which is bracing for its own budget woes made worse by federal cuts. Last week, New York State Budget Director Blake Washington warned the state expects an additional $3 billion deficit next year, in part due to President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act and its cuts to Medicaid and SNAP. The fare-free bus idea would also need approval from the state overall, because the MTA is a state-created entity that is heavily influenced by the governor. Mamdani, or whoever wins in November, couldn't just tell the MTA what to do. Like Westchester County, the MTA is in the middle of efforts to crack down on fare evasion, especially on buses. Asked about the proposal of free buses on New York One this morning, Chair Jana Lieber appeared to dodge the question.
I'm thrilled that, you know, investments in transit and making the transit system better and faster is something that people are talking about. It is, as we always say, the lifeblood of New York. And it makes sense for, you know, people who want to run the city of New York to be talking about that. We'd welcome it.
Eric Goldwyn, program director at NYU's Marin Institute of Urban Management, says free buses are not impossible, but smaller cities with smaller bus systems have had more success. The way he sees it, the debate boils down to, what are the city's goals? If the goal is to increase affordability for riders, then free buses would certainly achieve that. But so might expanding the MTA's Fair Fares program, offering half-off fares to more low-income riders. Goldwyn worries completely free buses could make the system vulnerable to disinvestment in the future, which would mean poorer service for those that rely on it.
My concern would be if there are changes in the economy that free bus service means, well, we'll just scale back the service and it'll come less frequently so that we're paying less to operate the buses. And then that makes the bus less attractive to riders, which means people will not ride the buses often. And it just leads to sort of a vicious cycle of disinvestment and just worse and worse service.
Goldwyn says he's more focused on achieving a faster and more reliable bus system that gives riders more bang for their buck. He says there's a lot the city can do on that front. It can allow riders to board at the front and rear doors, add more bus lanes, consolidate stops, and install traffic lights that give buses priority.
the concern is you don't want the bus to become the mode of last resort. You want it to be attractive and competitive. It can be, especially in congested places, if you give the bus priority.
Pearlstein, with the Riders Alliance, agrees what riders want the most is reliable and affordable service. And he doesn't see why they should have to choose between the two.
What I think the critics sometimes lose sight of here is who bus riders are. And in New York City, bus riders are overwhelmingly essential workers who are underpaid and who have been squeezed in so many different ways in terms of time and in terms of money. And that's why making buses fast and free is so exciting.
Election day is November 4th. As for the Hudson Valley, Westchester County is not the only government to try free buses. This year, Orange County paid to cover free buses in both Newburgh and Middletown. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Local leaders from around the North Country gathered in Alexandria Bay this month to learn more about nuclear energy. It's in response to the state announcing its intent to build a new power plant. As the New York Public News Network's Catherine Wheeler reports, they see jobs and economic growth if they can persuade the state to choose the region.
A couple of weeks ago, Governor Kathy Hochul sent shockwaves through New York.
I am proud to announce that I'm directing the New York State Power Authority to develop and construct a brand new advanced nuclear plant in upstate New York. Announcing that here today, and we're going to get it done.
It came as somewhat a surprise. New York actually decommissioned a nuclear power plant in the Hudson Valley just a couple of years ago. But Hochul says the state needs this plant to meet its clean energy goals, which it's very behind on. She says it would produce at least a gigawatt of energy, enough to power about 750,000 homes. Immediately, the big question was out there. Where is this thing gonna go?
In the North Country, we're never gonna have an opportunity unless we raise our hand and we step out there and say, hey, we're here.
On Tuesday, Assemblyman Scott Gray gathered more than 100 local leaders from around the North Country at Bonnie Castle Resort in Alexandria Bay. It was an informational session to talk about nuclear energy and the opportunities it presents, jobs and economic development. They heard from nuclear advocates, scientists, state agency representatives, and union members. Speakers talked about how nuclear energy works, how facilities are constructed, and addressed concerns about safety and nuclear waste. Gray says it was just a baby step, but he says it shows the state that the North Country is laying the groundwork.
I think you saw a receptivity, right, from the community that is saying, hey, you know, listen, this isn't the bad boogeyman that, you know, it's perceived to be. And that we're willing to step up, we're willing to talk about this, we're willing to listen and engage.
At the meeting, an official from the New York Power Authority said the state is still building the team that will oversee the project, but they're already looking for communities to show interest. For the right spot, the state says it wants to see strong community support, and it'll consider other factors like the workforce, land, and current infrastructure. Town of Champion supervisor John Peck says the North Country could check a lot of those boxes. Peck says a major nuclear power plant could bring a lot of steady, good-paying jobs and lower people's electricity bills.
You talk about the things that affect people personally and help them understand that this is going to be a generational transition. You know, that's the kind of things that we've been waiting for in the North Country.
Some are already pitching potential locations. One is Fort Drum. Last year, it was reported that the state and Army were discussing building a small nuclear reactor there to power the base. St. Lawrence County legislator David Forsyth says Messina would be perfect. Earlier this year, a company that had already prepared a site for a green hydrogen plant scrapped its plans.
The land's cleared. I think it's ready to go, and it's right next to NYPA. Plus the transmission line, look at the smart path. It's all been constructed, housed right through there. So I think it'd be hard-pressed to find a better spot, really.
A lot of elected officials walked into the meeting with concerns about safety. Waddington Mayor Mike Zagrobelny said he got some of those questions answered, but he still wonders if the state could choose this region for nuclear energy development.
Would it really be possible to have it sited in the North Country? And we don't know the answer to that, but I'm hopeful with the amount of support that was here. And so that question didn't get answered, but I think it got fueled.
Local government leaders say they're taking the information they gather back home to discuss with their communities. Gray says he'll be looking to gauge their willingness and what more they need to know. In Alexandria Bay, I'm Catherine Wheeler for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Many, especially New York State leaders, have been sounding the alarm about crippling consequences coming from Medicaid cuts included in the Big Beautiful Bill that President Trump signed this month. But the Empire Center's Bill Hammond says New York is better positioned than most states to weather the loss of federal support. In a piece for the right-leaning think tank, Hammond argues that even with a possible $10 billion worth of lost revenue and increased expenses as a result of impending changes, New York's Medicaid program and its Essential Plan, a Medicaid-like program funded through the Affordable Care Act, are not set to collapse. Hammond spoke with the Legislative Gazette's Andrew Waite.
That's a lot of money. I'm not gonna try to downplay that. But in just the last year alone, our Medicaid system increased by, I think it's $11 billion. So, and we were starting from a very high place. We were starting from being the state that spent more on Medicaid than any other state. Plus, we have the Essential Plan, which is virtually unique. We had just a lot of money flowing from the federal government and from these two programs into the healthcare system. Even if the worst case scenarios pan out in terms of this bill, we're still going to have more money than we had when Hochul took office, a lot more probably, and we're still going to have the most money of any state. And so I think this, the kind of catastrophization that you're hearing from people of saying that we can't possibly backfill these cuts, they're devastating, it's gutting Medicaid, it's gutting our healthcare system. Those are just overstatements.
Do you feel like New York has expanded spending past the need?
Well, one measure of that I found in a report, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but after enactment of the Affordable Care Act, we saw our uninsured population go down substantially. It's down to 5%. I think we knocked about 1 million people out of the uninsured population, but our Medicaid enrollment went up by like 3 million. I mean, these are round numbers and I don't have them in front of me. My point is that when we add someone to Medicaid, we're not necessarily taking them out of uninsured. We might be taking them out of employer provided insurance. And in fact, some people, It's a well-documented phenomenon in the Medicaid world that people who have Medicaid don't always know it. They're not always aware that they're enrolled in the program. And they may have a job, they may have other insurance. They're still technically enrolled in Medicaid, but they're not using it. And so if they lose their coverage, they don't become uninsured. They just are no longer on Medicaid. I expect that's part of what's going to happen as a result of this work requirement that's being imposed on able-bodied adults on Medicaid. I think some of them are going to get notified by the state, hey, we're about to cut off your Medicaid unless you report your work. And they're going to go, I'm not on Medicaid or I don't need Medicaid. So that's not going to be all of it, but that's going to be some of it.
Yeah, I mean, there will be a sizable population that does lose coverage as a result of this.
That's hard to know. I mean, there's one population that definitely will lose coverage, and that's non-citizens.
Right.
They have pretty much always been cut out of Medicaid. At least the federal government has not provided aid, that provided money to put them on Medicaid. So the state has been doing some of those people. If you go back to pre-ACA times, the state was providing some coverage for non-citizens out of its own pocket with no federal assistance. And then in addition to that, the ACA made these non-citizens eligible for tax credits so they could buy commercial insurance through the exchanges. This bill takes that away. Pretty much all non-citizens are no longer eligible for the tax credits. And New York has been using that tax credit money to finance the essential plan. So about 200 and something thousand people are going to be kicked out of the essential plan, but also they're not going to have any viable alternative. They're not going to have, they could theoretically buy commercial insurance, but likely it will not be affordable to them without tax credits. And so that's 200, maybe 250,000 people who are directly losing their insurance with no alternative available. The other big chunk of the Cuomo administration is, the Hochul administration is estimating that 1.2 million people will lose insurance because of the work requirement. I think that's a very high estimate. And if the state does a good job of making it easy to comply with the work requirement, which that's the state's job, they can keep that number down. And that's also a group of people who do have alternatives. These are people, by and large, who have jobs. They're above the poverty line. They are, many of them are above the poverty line. They may already have other insurance, as we just discussed. They may be working off the books. And so they'll have a tough choice. Do I want to continue working off the books or do I want to go legit so I can stay on Medicaid? I think a lot of people will decide, no, I'm going to continue working off the books and I'm going to give up my Medicaid if they're healthy.
The Empire Center's Bill Hammond speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Andrew Waite. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2529. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.